This is panel 523, the death of the NFL. My name is Tom Zeiler. I'm a professor of history and chair of the International Affairs Program here at CU Boulder. It's a pleasure to have you all here and welcome our two panelists. Let me just start before I introduce them. It's a topic, the future of the NFL, been a topic for a while now, and certainly last fall was really on the radar. Chicago Tribune article last November noted that this multi-billion-dollar National Football League might be brought to its knees for a few reasons. The moral dilemma of brain trauma, controversy over players kneeling or fists raised in the air during the national anthem, that was embedded, and controversy embedded in American race and racism, and policing, and nationalism, even radicalization, someone said, from players' unity. Another issue of utter consumer commercialization of football, food and beverage sales, television, of course, you see team gear, with the NFL, say some critics, even desperately appealing, especially middle class women, as a fan base. And win them over as the savior of the league. And you've had parents who refuse to expose their kids to potential brain or injuries, and so withdrawn them from youth football in droves around the country. And there might even be a cultural term, and hopefully our panelists will talk about all of these issues. Cultural term, though, perhaps some have said the ascendant NBA better reflects American values and youth culture than more old fashioned. More white NFL that's so popular in the Decatur Midwest and also in the South. Are we looking at the death of the American national pastime? And I say that as somebody who teaches a course in American history through baseball, because I think American football is the national pastime now. I've always thought that the Super Bowl weekend should be a three-day holiday rather than President's Day or Columbus Day. But are we looking at the decline and death of the national pastime or the national football league? So let's ask our two panelists that. First up, to my far right, and your far left, is Joe Sexton. Looked him up, not to be confused with the snowboarder Joe Sexton, although I don't know if he snowboarded by the same name. He's a senior editor ProPublica, a longtime award-winning reporter and editor at the New York Times. Joe served as a metropolitan editor at the Times from 2006 to 2011. From 2011 to 2013, he served as a paper sports editor. His work, a lot of other awards and blogs has been anthologized in the Best American Sports Writing. Chris Borland, immediately to my right, is founder and CEO of T-Mindful LLC, a company that integrates meditation into athletics. An All-American linebacker at the University of Wisconsin, he was drafted by the San Francisco 49ers in the third round of the 2014 NFL Draft and appeared in his first game against our Denver Broncos, where we recorded 8 sacks, tackles, and even sacked Peyton Manning. Not going to hold that against him. Yeah, hold on. Here now. Chris was named the all-rookie team into the Pro Bowl the next year he retired from the NFL over concerns of brain injury. He's gone on to work in concussion awareness advocacy, including as a consultant in the film Concussion and in numerous appearances in television. Welcome to both of you.
Is the mic working?
Yeah.
Let's just get something straight. I call this sack big man.
That's true.
A little bit of background. I grew up in Brooklyn, obviously. I radiate, athleticism. Enormous, bones be chiseled, rather should be good looking. So I've lived the life of a star athlete for some time. But I grew up loving sports, and played all kinds of them in Brooklyn, on grass and concrete. I was the son of a father who grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, and raised me a Green Bay Packers fan. I actually watched the Ice Bowl live on TV. And I was, you know, as a kid in Brooklyn, a pretty big fan of Lyles, too. The regular feature of our lives, and we used to play roller hockey, a crude sport, if there ever was one, which was really just an excuse for different, you know, dads and kids in the neighborhood to get together and beat the shit out of each other. And I remember at one point, the particular highlight was, you know, the park where we used to use roll up a piece of electric tape was dropped, and then everybody was fighting instantly. And all of a sudden, there's somebody's helmet falls off, and somebody picks the helmet up, lights it on fire, puts it on top of the stick. It's like the fucking Roman Coliseum. I loved the NFL and all of its roughness for most of my life. Went on to become a sports writer and ultimately served as a sports editor. And, you know, it was work done by the New York Times reporter, Alan Schwartz, who really began to turn the light on the question of identities in football. And over really the better part of 3 years, did a devastating array of reporting on the NFL's dishonesty and intentional. Well, it constituted basically intentional harming of the very players who helped them make their billions. But I thought today I would start somewhat in an unorthodox way and take my 10 minutes to do just one thing, which is to read you a story. And it's a story that was done at the New York Times by a very good friend of mine named Dan Barry. And then I'll let Chris pick it up, and then we can get to questions. But this is much of anything, at least with respect to the question of traumatic brain injuries, frames the issue as well as anything I could say. So, here goes. Doylestown, PA. The mother sat at the edge of her bed. Angel figurines gazed down from the shelf and a wooden sign on the wall offered inspirational words about life. They provided no comfort. She was on the edge, cell phone pressed to her ear. This fraught conversation with her son had started as a quarrel over his scattering ways. A Dartmouth graduate a decade out of college should be able to balance his checkbook. But not Patrick, whose troubles in navigating everyday life frustrated everyone, especially Patrick. His mother, Karen Kinzel Zagel, sent him a maternal text message to calm down, all will be well. He sent a quick response that, if you knew Patrick Bishop at this stage, reflected either bristling anger or unnerving apathy. I am calm. Now her son is on the phone again, saying disturbing things in a casual tone. As she looks back on that late night last September, their conversation wasn't just about a measly $400 bank overdraft. It was about football. The word was never uttered, but that's what this was really about, football. Patrick Grisham was born into a football family in a football-first community, Pennsylvania's Monongahela Valley, where the past art might well be mountainous. His mountainous father had educated him, Pat Grisham, played college football and earned renown in the Mon Valley as the coach at Clareton High, who specialized in motivating disadvantaged students. You'll succeed if you have heart, he shouted. Players felt honored just to be hit by his saliva. One day, Risha asked Karen Kinzel, a petite school nutritionist, on a date. Then she didn't hear from him for 2 months, only to find out later the reason football playoffs. I should have known then that marriage was doomed, she jokes. Their two children, Patrick and Manny, grew up mid-sentence in a never-ending football conversation. It was all about the big game Friday night, then defensive adjustments for the next game, then field conditions for the next, and on and on. In the summer, they vacationed at a football camp, dad and his assistants in one bunkhouse, mom and the kids in another. At 6, Patrick was the Clareton mascot, wearing oversized pads as wide as he was long. At 10, he was a mighty Mike in the Mon Valley Midget Football League. He was the kid forever asking, do you think I have enough heart, Dad? He became a regional celebrity as running back at Elizabeth Ford High School. The horse, he was called, grinding out yards with his team on his back and walking off the field helmetless and revealed, a gridiron prince awashing blood, sweat, and proud. Newspapers trumpeted his exploits. Risha runs over Titans. Warriors, Risha outlast Cougars. Warriors drive Risha into WPIAL playoffs. Risha rolls. His mother wore his jersey, cheering to carry the ball like the precious baby he once had been, tucked, secure. His little sister prayed for him to rise from her cattle, unhurt, so that he could keep on banging and spinning like a human top. The family lived through these American nights. It was football, Nathan says. It was what we did. His mother remembers the external cost of all his games and practices. His entire body, she says, like a piece of meat. But at times it seemed something was going on internally as well. The occasional fits of rage over nothing, a dead swallowed bottle of Tylenol being grounded for drinking. All aberrations was decided in the art of a smart, well-mannered teenager with high degrees. After high school, Patrick attended Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts for a year, where he started, of course, in football and got accepted to Dartmouth. It looked as if his dedication to the game had paid off, his future secured. He graduated in 2006 with a degree in government and a lingering disappointment his up and down college career, which included a back injury that introduced him to pain killers. Still, he was known as a solid teammate and an aggressive competitor. A pounding running back for Paul Chris Walton, a teammate who later married Lisa. He just loved the contact. But again, there were signs that something was off. The horse returned to the Mon Valley. Unable to carry himself, he gambled online, he took painkillers, he spent money he didn't have. He had fits of anger that overshadowed his big heart and nature. Most of all, he seemed overwhelmed by the prospect of paying a bill or updating a cell phone plan. It was just hard to relate to a man, he says. I think, is he lazy? And I would just pop and do it for him. One story in the lore of this new package stands out. In a single meeting, October 2010, his sister married his former teammate, his longtime girlfriend gave birth to his son, whom they named Peyton, after yes, Manny. And his father, by then a controversial local power broker, died. It was a lot for anyone to take in. Several months later, he learned that his sister and brother-in-law had received their prepaid wedding video. His response? To break into the videographer's home with a sledgehammer and replay the wedding video in those of several other couples. The intent behind this criminal act was honorable in a way, even sweet. That video contained his divorced parents together, his little sister's big day, and some of his father's last moments. But the break-in also reflected a disregard for consequences. Really, Patrick? A sledgehammer? His guilty plea to a misdemeanor provided no reawakening of the old Patrick. He seemed even less focused, less aware of consequence. One day, he showed his mother a few boxes in 6 months of unopened mail. His family began to wonder, maybe all this had to do with football. Patrick had been overheard saying he once came off a high school field with no memory of having scored 2 touchdowns. But now where Patrick was on the line for Mon Valley, 300 miles west of her girl's town bedroom, where she sat on the edge. He was talking flat about standing on a ladder with Alicia Diesel, his black lab, around his neck. He was dismissing her pleas to see what was good in his life, and she was trying to discern between bluff and truth, and then. Patrick? Examinations of the brain of Patrick Risha, 32, at the University of Pittsburgh and Boston University revealed chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, the degenerative disease caused by repeated blows to the head. Have been found in the brains of dozens of former football players. CTE has been linked to depression, impulsive actions, and short-term memory loss, among other symptoms. Karen Kinzel Sable is 61, remarried and getting on with things. She recently began a website, www.stopcte.org, for a foundation she has established in Patrick's name. She is fine until she isn't. All his Friday night regrets. After her final words with Patrick last fall, she he would try to lose himself in reading some garden behind the cameras. He wanted to hear the resounding cheers of fans at another Central Box High School West football game. It was all he could do to keep from hustling over there to sound the warning. She knows the cheering will return in a few months. This time she will go. She will go and talk to the mothers.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. This is our fifth panel together. We started Monday with prescription drugs. Wednesday, we picked up with corruption in sports, and today we're ending with the death of the NFL. So a joyous week for me and Joe.
Job well done.
This morning, my host, Don, asked me an interesting question. He said, "You seem so calm. How'd you play football? You're not this hyper-aggressive, angry person." And that's true. It was an insightful point, Don. I tried to describe to him what it's like prepping for a game, what it's like to put on the helmet, have your ankles taped, to hear the murmur of tens of thousands of people filing into the stadium, and the excitement of that. And many of the best players in the NFL and years past and today are actually pretty preserved off the field. There's something about walking into that arena, something about the violence of the game that you've been conditioned to play for years that brings something more out. And so I definitely was both off the field very calm, but I think equally intense when I stepped between the lines. I see a 49ers fan, maybe he remembers some of that. This week at CWA, I feel like Joe and I are that dichotomy as well. So I'm pretty reserved and reticent and calm about things. I'm the guy that was on the field, and I'm the guy that, I know Patrick, Christian's mom, we've worked together. And Joe's up there on these panels of prescription drugs and corruption in sports, ranting and raving and cursing. I love it. I absolutely love it. Joe's the between the lines version of how I was in football. And so I considered last night, maybe I'd try to harness some Joe, maybe get a little wig and a goatee to be my helmet and cage, throw on some glasses and tell people how I really, really, truly feel. Sometimes I walk the line of trying to make progress. I think it's really easy to be antagonistic. It's really easy to fight something. It's really easy to call out the injustice that the NFL has perpetrated over the last quarter century. And so for the last few years, I've really tried to make incremental improvements, give them their due, say progress is being made. But in reality, I think those are half-truths. Most of what goes on, I think, is PR. If you've been following this issue at all, you hear safer than ever. It doesn't mean shit. Like, safer than ever is a euphemism for dangerous. There's never been a safer time to hit yourself in the face with a hammer. The NFL will talk about, just a few weeks ago, they passed a rule about not being able to lower your head. What's going to happen is a couple of times, maybe in September or October, they'll throw a flag on a marquee player in order to make it a news story and say the game's getting safer because of these types of rules. The nature of CTE, the nature of brain injury, the nature of other issues that players have after their career doesn't have to do with single incidences of bad concussions. It's the accumulation of subconcussive hits over thousands and thousands and thousands of practices, games, off-season workouts, and the like. And that's something that the whole framing of this issue has been cast as a concussion problem. You can have a concussion, recover, and be fine. You can't play 70 plays at middle linebacker in the Big Ten and then practice a day and a half later for 60 or 70 reps and then do it for 3 days in a row, have a day or two off, and go out and play 75 more snaps on Saturday and do that for 25 weeks in a row, 20 weeks in a row. That's the problem. And so I am optimistic in some ways, but I feel like I've watered myself down and allowing this conversation to take place on the NFL's ground, on the NCAA's ground, on youth football's ground. And the reality is, yes, we can make things safer, we can improve the game, but men will suffer and die And we've seen children as young as 17 have a unique pathology, a brain disease, from an extracurricular activity, publicly funded at their high school. So I don't want to mince words, and I don't want to water myself down. I think what's transpired from the top down for, in some ways, the last quarter century since journalists started to break it, like Alan and Joe and others at New York Times and other places, but in other ways for over a century. Dementia pugilistica was discovered in 1928. It's more commonly referred to as punch drunk. For us to take almost 90 years to extrapolate that to football, I think speaks to the industrial influence that we've seen with the popularity of the NFL and obscuring the science. So we only have 50 minutes. I'm sure we'll have a lot of great questions. I'll leave it at that and hope we get into everything. Thank you.
As you mentioned, and Joe, your very moving reading there deals with kids, and so we have several questions on that subject. I see parents asking, what advice would you have for a fifth grader starting the path of playing football today? And that's, again, we have several of those. A seven-year-old wants to play flag football now, so let him play tackle football. Refuse.
What advice would you give?
So one thing that's not within that article is Patrick Risho's family is working to change youth football into flag at the age of 14. And I've been behind efforts like that. There's now legislation in four different states. I testified in Illinois about a month ago about retooling youth football into solely flag. It's actually a silver lining in an often gloomy topic is that athletically, it's better for you. If you were to give me a talented seven-year-old that wanted to play football down the road, youth tackle football doesn't develop all that much athleticism. You hardly go backwards or sideways. It's so front-oriented. Also, it's essentially who hits puberty first, runs around and runs everybody over. So I think waiting until high school is a great idea for kids. I think it's inevitable. Five-year-old putting on body armor and hitting one another is going to look like an anachronism when we look back in 2018. We've got a ton of panels this week about AI and about, you know, the future. And it's just something that sticks out like a sore thumb. So waiting until high school is my advice for that kid.
And Chris, too, matter better for personally and scientifically. But I think I guess I'm a little surprised that Richard Mom is, I mean, it's clearly a step forward, but at least I always read the end of that article to be that what she was predicting or projecting was that, and this has been one of the things that when people say, what will be the end of the NFL? And, you know, talk about ratings or, you know, the controversy over the anthem or, you know, shifting demographics of America and appetite for different sports. But the one that's always been most powerful and actually in the end most perhaps effective, if that's what people feel compelled to do, is that moms will not let their children play. And we say moms, and, you know, as a dad, as a one-time single dad, I don't mean to diminish the dad's role, but I think we, you know, moms are often less conflicted about the sort of, you know, having been inculcated in the fun and appetite and excitement of football. So they might be a more objective and rational person in that household. But, you know, I printed out some stuff last night, but, you know, right, and this is mostly known to you, I'm sure. The size of the players in the NFL has grown, you know, incredibly over the last 30 years. The speed of the players, thus the force of the collisions that they place on the field. And even if you take the brain stuff out of it, right, just go down, you know, you can even Google it, just go down the annual list of injuries for NFL players. You know, it's like a dunker. single season, whether it's knees, ankles, necks, backs, hands, fingers. And so we did this little thing that I looked at last night. They sort of place a NFL collision today on a scale of, you know, what would it, and it's like a 25-mile-an-hour car wreck without a seatbelt on. So what mother would say to their kid, hey, Chris, go out and play in fucking traffic, you know, and try to get hit. Try to tackle that fucking car. You know, it's right on some level, the most simplifying. But in many ways, that's the proposition. And if enough parents out of love, worry, whatever, said they're not going to let their kids play, that, I think, might get that in their trouble.
Thanks, both of you. We got a lot of great questions here. And mostly honest, just thanking both of you for being on this channel, for talking about this. Let me alter this a little bit, combine some of these, because it's a more personal issue, too, that brought up by some of the panelists. One question asks, would you do it again? You know, that there were, there've been football players, coaches interviewed, and said, who have ended up injured and, you know, living, you know, in the 50s, 60s, or whatever, in bad shape. But when asked, said, it was the best time in my life. So related to that, too, do both of you also watch games on Sunday? And related to that, somebody's asked here, are we all co-conspirators in this, writing about the game, watching the game, buying tickets?
The first part of the question, whether or not I'd do it again, I can answer that in a couple of ways. One, I'm 27. The nature of CTE is an insidious disease that creeps in over decades. So right now, yes, if you're asking me if I would do it again, I would. Ask me again at 60, 70, and beyond. If I can track dementia, if I don't remember my children's names or can't hold down a job, no, it's a no-brainer, and that's a tired pun, but no, why would I ever allow that to happen for any reason, any amount of money or fame or joy? And the second part of that question is, I think when you ask these former players, who, you've had to have a pretty terrible life to say I regret my entire life. I think most people towards the end, no matter how things went, will say, you know, I learned a lot, and I enjoyed my life, and I do it over the same way. I've been in interviews where they're asking a player if he'd do it all again. A guy like Tony Dorsett, whose struggles with CTE symptoms are well documented. Off camera, the women in his life? No. And no one talks about that. Alan is beginning to really talk about that. Alan Schwartz, who broke a lot of this news. His latest TED Talk is all about women in football. There's a Facebook group of thousands of women. And this problem with acknowledging the reality of CTE is closely tied to this false sense of bravado, that you're tough somehow. So I think it's a worthwhile question. I think it's best for the people that are close to athletes, maybe not the former athletes themselves. In terms of watching, no, I haven't watched any. It's not in protest. I'm not out to get anybody. It's a hard-earned apathy. Spending a lot of time with people who've had these struggles, knowing the research, and potentially being someone that may deal with it in my life, it's just not a part of my life. And a piece of my heart will always be in football. It's given me so much, and I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't acknowledge that. But I can't possibly rationalize supporting it. I do think anyone who does is a part of the problem.
And so most of my shit, and Chris has, I'm sure, grown quite weary of it over these 5 times, kind of be wise to ask and whatever. So I'm going to break that tradition a little bit and just say that it has really been a great privilege and delight to be with Chris this week. And in any number of respects, I've found, you know, on any number of panels myself, saying, oh, that's better than me. And I just did it again, and Chris says he didn't watch, because I do. And I didn't come here, you know, trying to make the argument that, you know, it is, a, you know, morally unacceptable to watch football, or to be a fan of it, or to play it. I mean, I feel strongly conflicted. I want people to be equipped with the information so that if they choose to watch it, that they do so wittingly. And, you know, so, you know, I've made my own kind of, you know, call which one cowardly or convenient choice to watch and enjoy it and then kind of come off self-righteous and act like this or read a heartbreaking story. But I actually think, you know, that's what's so hard and fascinating about the topic is, you know, it's hard to let go, it's hard to prioritize what matters to you. It's easy to, you know, to see it out of a roof. And, you know, I was just struck by Chris's excellent point, you know, asking all the athletes to do it again, yeah, and, you know, their moms and their wives and their kids, you know, I'm sure they'd say no.
Thank you. Let me ask even more difficult question about class or poverty. We have several questions in this regard, and even about gender or sexual orientation. Aaron Hernandez committed suicide. The injury was also simultaneously called out for being gay. So is the NFL in some way covering or distracting people there, but also about poverty. So we're talking about gender, race, and class. Is the fall off of kids in football, mostly in upper class schools, is this still looked at as a way out of poverty for other kids? And so you're going to have class, even greater class divisions in the sport.
Yeah, before he passed away a couple of years ago, Frank DeFord, who's a famous sports journalist, when asked that very question, said participation in football, the existence of football, isn't a commentary on health. It's a commentary on social and racial issues. And we've seen it in boxing. I mentioned earlier, Punch Drunk was discovered in 28. We still, 1928, we still have boxing. And most of the men who step in the ring aren't from middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods. We've seen youth tackle football leagues dwindle in places like, you know, the north side of Chicago. Conversely, places like where I'm from, a Rust Belt town in the Midwest, it's not going anywhere. It's still small towns in Ohio where baby boys have a football put in their bassinet at the hospital. So it's so woven into the cultural fabric of places that are otherwise destitute that I think it is about class. I think it is about race, which is concerning because I think a lot of that rationalization of supporting it may have some racial undertones. SEC football, if you've seen, what's the title of that, Django Unchained? SEC football is like Mandingo fighting. I mean, these kids, and I've got friends that play to places, are treated like property. And I think it's perpetrated along racial lines. I think it's perpetrated along taking advantage of people that don't have other options.
And, you know, I had a great 3 years coming to this conference. One of the low points, not, it's no fault of the conference itself, was I was on an early panel, something along the lines of sports and corruption or whatever. And there was a guy who was a former AD at Michigan, I think, and had been on the U.S. Olympic Committee. And with a straight face, he made the argument that, well, you know, these kids have a choice to play around. I was like, you bullshit artist. I mean, and I did actually say that. I got invited back. He didn't. But, you know, to Chris's point, too, right? I mean, it's one thing to focus on the NFL, right? The NFL doesn't exist if it doesn't have college football, its minor league system, you know, if it doesn't have, and college doesn't, if it doesn't. So, all of the reckoning, you know, want to call it moral reckoning or practical reckoning, you know, is not just at the NFL, but at a team more cynical at the fucking NCAA level. The idea that it's a completely of your own volition, free choice about whether or not you want to play football, if you're coming out of a background where the potential riches or even the modest riches of a professional career are so enormously appealing and essential, that's not a free choice.
Well, some of you have also asked questions that alluded to the violence as the appeal, that's appealing to many people. So there's some questions on that, too. One pretty good one I mentioned, but you mentioned race, too. Let me ask this one. If an NFL player is killed on live television, will the reaction be different if he is a white player versus a black player? Will ratings go up or down? In other words, I think you're going to work out.
That's about the Darby's question.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying it's illegitimate.
We're trying to get to this question of trying to move also as we end here to the question of will the NFL die? But
the first part of that question, I don't know. I'm going to shirk the first part because I just don't know, and I don't want to pretend like I could prognosticate whether if it was a black or white player passing, it would change things. I think I played with two of the most popular players in the NFL in college. I played with Russell Wilson and J.J. Watt. They could collide at the 50-yard line of the Super Bowl, both simultaneously die, and I think a lot of people would tune in the next year to watch football. There's this assumption that players understand the risks. There's this idea that players involved in it have some unique insight into the science behind this. It's a uniquely vulnerable population. You get your information from, you don't get any information, at least in my experience growing up. It may have changed, I've been involved in some things, but I think in reality, high school coaches in a lot of places are ill-informed, if informed at all. College football is a billion-dollar industry. They're not going to tell players the specifics about CTE. I haven't once been invited to mention anything I've learned over the last 3 years. I was an All-American of some sort at Wisconsin every year I played. We had a premier boxing program in the 50s until a player died in the ring that precipitated the end of college boxing. The pathologist that's done more autopsies than anyone in the world on former football players is a Wisconsin alum. I haven't heard a peep from the athletic department. Our former team doc for 25 years in Wisconsin is the head of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and he travels the country teaching safe tackling. I made 450-some tackles at Wisconsin. There's no way to do it safely. So I don't think the NFL is going to die. I think, like Frank DeFord said, it will be about class and race. If it hasn't died yet, I mean, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, Brett Favre, his struggles are well documented. The greatest center of all time, another Wisconsin alum, Mike Webster, died young age. If you're familiar with the story, it's incredibly sad. There's a player at almost every position, Junior Seau, linebacker, on and on and on. So what's happened, it hasn't happened in real time on the field, but I don't think it takes too much imagining to extrapolate it to the accumulation and what guys go through decades later.
So it doesn't sound like football is going to go the way of boxing. There are questions here about will it become more of a fringe sport out there like boxing now, which used to be, you know, 40 years ago, from here, Muhammad Ali, you know, sort of a fringe.
I don't know. I think my main things, historian would be one of them, a scholar, I think the history of America, if you want to look at that, would be instructive. I don't think the NFL is going to be around forever. The money's too big.
So are we overstating the decline?
the very title of this panel?
I thought the title was more meant to be a provocative question than declaration.
I think there's a couple of reasons why I would go the way of boxing. It's a team sport, one, and then two, it's tied to education, and that's uniquely American. So from high school on through college, we were sitting in an auditorium that I'm sure football played some role in contributing to financially. Colorado's greatest player shot himself in the park a couple years ago. Another great linebacker took his life recently. And I hear Go Buffs and walk by a picture of a buffalo every square foot here. So I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
We just have a few minutes left here. So there's some other questions, just a few more that are here. Talk about what the NFL, whether you would like to see it. I don't want to put you on the spot. What about college football? You were at a school that's meeting in college football. You had a great run last year, at least. Is that in some way covered up by university administrations? The fan enthusiasm comes above the safety. Are we blaming the NFL too much while we should be blaming the
fans? Yeah, I think Chris just answered that question about as powerfully as you can. And as a Wisconsin alum myself, just shameless that this man hasn't been asked back to talk to the players there. But if I, maybe in my second to last panel, usurp some of the, I hope I don't make him uncomfortable. But it's a question I have for Chris. And he doesn't have to go there, he doesn't want to. But just to, I sort of try to open on a moment of personal sorrow or reckoning. In many ways, I think you can make the argument, Chris's argument is made, right, that the years of the NFL's ignorance or pretended ignorance and deception, whatever, ultimately helped rob Chris of his career. Had they been more honest and money, maybe he wouldn't have ever played football. Had they been more honest, maybe he would have taken greater care at certain points. But I've never heard you talk exactly about, those, I don't know what it was, hours, weeks, moments where you had to really decide, I can't do this thing that I love anymore.
Yeah, I'll answer that. I began looking into it at the onset of my rookie year. And I entered the NFL with a chip on my shoulder. There was one mock draft that Mel Kiper's draft had me going in the first round, the last pick of the first round with the Broncos. I actually got a call on that night from a wrong number at the exact time the Broncos were on the clock. And so I fell because of my size, maybe because of a couple injuries I'd had to the third round. And so I entered the NFL. I wanted to start right away. I wanted to play for at least 10 years, and I wanted to be a Hall of Famer. I wanted to be like the next Zach Thomas, but better. Zach Thomas is a really talented, undersized Hall of Fame linebacker. As I began to look into this, the first concession I made is I can't justify 10 plus years. And when you read the tragic stories, and I spoke with a few people that are close to the folks, like Junior Seau, people doing research, that was the first thing. It had been a dream of mine to play in the NFL since I was a little kid. And that was the first time I thought, I'm not a victim. My career wasn't robbed. That broke my heart. And then I made more concessions. I got later in the year, and I read more, and I talked to more people. Lofty goals of 10 plus years were out the window. The next stop was, well, then how long? And then I got to this point where I'm rationalizing playing football for what? For money? To get a pension? For fame? If I couldn't live my passion and reach my highest goals, what am I in it for? I got hurt the third to last game. I broke my ankle, so I was out for the last two games. And that's the first time I thought about walking away after 1 year. And I think by mid-January, the offseason knew that, that was what I was going to do. And I didn't tell the 49ers until March 13th, Friday the 13th, I think it was. Those 2 months from January to March, I was sick. I mean, I was deeply sick. I'd gone back to my hometown after the season ended. And by that time, I told my family and some close friends. But the world didn't know. And 49ers fans, Wisconsin fans, onlookers, suspected that, hey, this kid just made the Pro Bowl as an alternate. I'll leave that out of the time. after starting 8 games, I led the team in tackles. They were expecting, this was the start, from the outside perspective, of that Zach Thomas career trajectory. So anytime I was around town, I was a source of pride for a small community. I come from a football hotbed. We won our first state championship my senior year. And everybody, oh, we love what you did. This year, you played so well. We can't wait to see what you're going to do. And I had to put on face because internally I thought, wait, I'm going to throw it, you know, from their perspective, throw it all away. It was the hardest decision I've ever made. There was a huge part of me that just felt guilty. Looking back, I shouldn't have felt guilty, but you carry a lot of people with you. And I just felt like I let them down. I mean, that's not true, but it's the way it felt. So that was a hard couple of months. Thanks for asking the question, Joe. Always a pleasure. But you know, you gotta walk your own path. And you know, hopefully, thanks to people like Ann McKee and the moms and wives and daughters and families of other players that have shared their story, I was allowed to have a keyhole of insight into information that may have spared me my life. I'm trying to give back in every way I can. It's still trying not to cast, not to be critical of those who support it. I did it, so I know what it's like. I had that catharsis. I understand and empathize with fans. Having not experienced it, it'd be hard to know everything that goes on. So yeah, it's